Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It's David. It's podcast time. You know the drill. We're trying to make economics a little bit more comprehensible, a little bit more relevant, and hopefully a little bit more germane to everyone's life. Hope you had a good week. Mr. Davis, my man, how was your week?
It was really good, actually, Mac. Yeah, I actually got out to do a bit of a decent hike, which I've been wanting to do for a while. I persuaded a few of the lads to join me and told them that we'd, you know, out for 3 or 4 hour hike, which ended up being 7.5.
Oh, Jesus, John, where did you go?
No, we went up over Camaderry Mountain. See, we kind of lost the trail, so a lot of it was off-piste, tumbling down heather hills and stuff like that. It's great fun.
Just
then around by Turlock Hill and back into Glendalough. But of course, the worst bit of this kind of hiking, especially when you don't plan it so well, it's always the last stretch, which you think is, oh, we'd be back to the car in about a half hour, 2 hours later. So the lads are kind of broken. I wasn't in great shape myself.
Yeah. Remind me not to be getting those walking boots on the next time you enthuse me for a schlep.
You wouldn't be able for it, Mark. I'll get you out, though.
Listen, so all is good. Ireland, the commune is full. A band has moved in. So as you know, the control has waned again. The control systems are all gone. But no, we had a good week this week. Lucy's song. Do you remember Fair Play we played in April? She released it.
Yeah, absolutely.
This week, it just passed 1 million downloads, which is really amazing.
Wow, that is amazing.
You know, and no marketing, no publicity, none of that sort of stuff, except for, of course, yourself and myself plugging away, John. But and
well, she be looking for my cut.
She absolutely. Hold on a sec. Me first, okay? You can get your cut in time. I've invested
I'll
heavily
send the bailiff
in this,
around.
But she's a new single out called Runaway.
God, you sound like an old fogey there, Mac, with your singles.
Do we call them singles?
No, we call them tracks or something. Just not
a
singles.
A new track.
Okay. It's not Top of the Pops.
And of course, they're going to drop a new track.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have to drop it.
It dropped. We're dropping a new... Lucy's dropping a new track. She's just dropped a new track called Runaway. And we're gonna do what is now a tradition after one for us.
Yeah.
We're going to play out with Lucy McWilliams' new track called Runaway. So it's been a good week. Been a good week.
Excellent.
What are you making of all the new lockdown stuff?
Well, you know, I'm like everybody else. I'm absolutely sick of COVID and lockdown and all the rest. But, you know, it's a funny thing. With about 98, 99% of COVID tests being negative, I think it's made people a little bit more complacent with all the pent up anxiety and all the rest. People just want to get out. But this is the predicted second wave. Like, we knew this was coming. So we still need to remain vigilant and wear a feckin' mask.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And there's also a very sort of strange blame game going on. It seems that if you contrast the performance of the government, the last one, 3 months ago.
Yeah, they don't seem to be quite
this one.
Yeah, they don't seem to be quite on the case.
Yeah, these guys seem to be, they're kind of all over the shop.
Yeah, it's COVID fatigue.
You know, I certainly, talking to younger people, there is a real sense of, they feel there's an overreaction. They also feel they're getting blamed. And there's really little they can do.
Sure.
You know, what can they do? You know, they want to go out.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you've got to go out and go mental, but they want to go out. They want to hang out with their friends. And for them, again, it's this idea is that COVID is really remote.
Yeah.
Because they know that mortality rates amongst the young are incredibly low. And
yeah, true.
They understand that mortality rates in general in the population are quite low. And again, it's like anything, John, when you're 19, 20, 21,
yeah, you're mortality invincible.
You're absolutely invincible. But you know what I tell you, John, I've been reading this week about,
of course you have,
the hunter-gatherers and
ooh,
the transition between humans going from hunter-gatherers to humans going to become the agricultural revolution, the first agricultural revolution. Came across an amazing statistic, John, and it's important with the context of this conversation.
Go on.
In this, let's say, so for example, humans started to settle down around 10,000 BC. That's the archaeological evidence, right?
Yeah.
From 10,000 BC to 5,000 BC, the human population on Earth went from 4 million to 5 million. Which is a tiny, tiny, tiny increase. From 5,000 BC to, let's say, when Christ was knocking around chasing the moneylenders out of the temple, right? Do you remember that? Get out.
He was burning the bondholders.
Okay? Burning the bondholders. I'm not accepting that currency. Out you go, right? From the 5,000 BC to then, that 5,000 years, the human population goes up to 100 million.
Wow.
So
wow.
The first 5,000 years of, let's say, domestication, human population hardly increases at all. Second 5,000 years, it goes up 25 times. The question is why? Now, the problem with history is it gets very, very blurry the further back you go.
Hey, come here. How do they know this? Like, how do they count the population from back in those days?
From all sorts of carbon dating and carbon records and trying to figure out, you know, how many archaeological sites there were, etc. So, you know, these are, again,
so it's a fair bit of guesswork.
There's a fair amount of guesswork. But again, there's some really, really good demographic economists, historical economists who are out there working.
And it's an interesting area.
One of the fascinating things is then this comes back to COVID. The question then is, why did the human population, at a time when, and this is the interesting thing, at a time when human fertility increased, because the hunter, think about the hunter-gatherers, they actually staggered their children because you actually can't carry around more than one or two children if you're moving around.
Yeah, makes sense.
So hunter-gatherer women had far less children than settled women.
Right, yeah.
That what you see is a massive increase in fertility and increase in babies once we start to settle down in these communities. But then the question is, if there was an increase, a massive increase in fertility, why didn't the population increase dramatically?
Yeah.
And what must be the case is that when we began to settle down, when we began to domesticate animals, sheep, goats, cows, chickens, all that sort of stuff. We suddenly became exposed for the first time in human history. And if you go back human history, I mean, we were using fire for 200,000 or 300,000 years before this, right? Okay, as hunter-gatherers. So we were figuring out the world. But we get exposed to diseases, to pathogens, which existed in the animals, but we had no immunity to them. In the same way as COVID comes from Wuhan, jumps from a bat to a human, and the rest we know to be history in the last 12 months.
Well, allegedly, John.
Allegedly, right? But so the conclusion that these long-run demographers are having about economics of the Stone Age is that all the way up to now is that humans, by domesticating, ushered in a period which is probably the most lethal period in human history for humans, because we get exposed to influenza, to smallpox, to measles, to mumps, all these diseases, to all these various plagues.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, I was doing some reading on Mesopotamia, which was the first place that humans actually settled in cities, had states, had tax collectors, had grain stores, all that sort of stuff. Really interesting.
Yeah.
And the language they spoke is a language called Akkadian.
Okay.
And they were really well aware of contagion and epidemics. They understood exactly what was going on, that these were coming. These were diseases that were jumping from healthy people, from sick people to healthy people, right? But the word for epidemic in Akkadian literally means certain death. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah.
To come back to our lockdown, right? So we're talking about 7,000 years ago, John, right?
Mm.
They deployed exactly the same tactics that we are deploying now, despite all our advances in science and in medicine and everything. They had lockdowns. They had quarantines.
Track and trace.
They were suspicious of people from coming outside the city walls. They made people who were coming from outside the city walls quarantine outside the city.
Yeah, yeah.
They worried about the collapse in taxation. I mean, the great thing is this: the language they wrote in was cuneiform. Mm. And this has preserved enormous records now. They worried about the collapse in tax revenues because people weren't working, because the fields were fallow. They worried about spending too much money, about government spending when there wasn't revenue. So they worried about exactly the same things as we do now.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet the lockdown and quarantine existed 7,000 years ago.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
And are still very much the only policies we're deploying now, which I find that kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, time and time again, we see history beating itself. But so who were the guys that kind of recognised how sickness and disease were passed on? And also, who were the guys who came up with the idea of quarantining in the first place?
Oh, well, they had druids and they had medics and they had, if you think about the hunter-gatherers knew so much about the power of flowers and fauna and medicine and vegetation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And they passed this down orally, even though they settled. So they had quite a comprehensive understanding of basic medicine. They also had tax collectors, they had bureaucrats, they had kings, they had soldiers. So they had a structure in the economy that worked extremely well. In fact, I've just found evidence of the first Excel spreadsheet ever in cuneiform. Which is kind of shocking.
The whole Microsoft Office
suite. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was an Excel spreadsheet, which was actually had all these inputs and outputs about herds and how much milk they'd create. And if you invested in this herd, how much money you'd make at the far side. Kind of terrifying that they were being bullied by Excel in the same way as we are 7,000 years ago.
I always knew Bill Gates was a time traveller.
And they also had PowerPoints. This is where I saw the first PowerPoint as well.
Yeah, you see, Gates again.
They did, because they had investors and they'd go and make pitches to them. Like, it's not that dissimilar to us. It's mad shit. Right?
I love it. You see, nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed, except they had better suits, I suspect.
And amazing beards.
And they had fantastic beards. I mean, they would make the hipster ashamed of their bewaxed efforts. These fellas had curly beards, proper ones. And they also used wax, beeswax in the beard and everything. So nothing has changed at all.
I bet they had man bags and drinking oat milk in their frappuccinos.
I bet you they did have oat milk. I bet you they did. Well, of course they had plenty of oat milk, because you know what happened to them? They moved from the varied diet of the hunter-gatherer to a terrifyingly tiny sliver of a diet based on wheat and oats and barley.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the great things. And if you read your man Hariri, Yuval Hariri's book, Sapiens, which is a great book. And I know
it's a great book, yeah.
You know, he makes the point that the biggest fraud in history was this idea that was a progression from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to the settled, sedentary lifestyle.
Yeah.
He's saying that wasn't the case. In fact, the hunter-gatherer was a much freer geezer.
Yeah, and he actually said that they were, you know, almost like an elite. They had a much better lifestyle. They had a much healthier diet, much more varied diet, as he said.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to break their backs working as farmers.
They were like, I mean, even physically, John, they were at least 3 inches taller.
Oh, really?
Because their diet. So it's back to looking at graves and figuring out the size of skeletons and all that from archaeology.
Mm.
But let's come to the lockdown.
Let's.
What is fascinating for us is the fact that our lockdown is broadly similar to theirs. And our medical knowledge, although fantastically better than theirs, has been flummoxed by this pretty basic disease.
Yeah, right. So apart from their IT expertise and their experience with Microsoft Word, etc.
Ancient PowerPoints.
Yeah, exactly. But from an economics perspective, I suppose the likes of Cyrus the Great and Gilgamesh and all those kind of heads, I suppose they acted like the central bank and helicopter money, as it were, from those days. Are there other similarities or things that we can learn from those guys from way back when?
Well, I think there are similarities, John. You don't want to stretch these things too much. But what is very clear is that then the pandemics killed the majority of people.
Yeah.
That's why I go back to my idea that it was immunity in the second half of that 10,000-year period, learned over centuries,
yeah,
that survivors passed on the genetic information of immunity to their kids. Then once we became more immune to these diseases, the population goes through the roof because we're not being killed all the time by recurrent pandemics.
Sure.
We're being killed, but we figured out how to deal with them and quarantine them, and we have certainly immunity. So you see that humans built up immunity. And the best way you see this is that when Western Europeans arrived in Latin America,
yes,
those people have been cut off from us for 12,000 years. And we gave them smallpox straight away, yeah, a disease that we'd built up a certain amount of immunity, and it killed almost 80% of them. But then the thing is, we still don't have total immunity to the common cold. But the point is, it doesn't kill us, so it doesn't matter.
But it's constantly evolving.
But if it kills you, then you need to build up immunity. Anyway, so and those populations. Anyway, the point I was thinking about was where we really have lost our imagination on this, John, is on the economics, right? So let's think about lockdown two.
Right.
Lockdown two. Commercial property goes through the floor because people are not allowed to go back to the office, let alone want to go back, even if people don't want to go back. And I believe people don't want to go back, as we talked about last week. And there will be a real change in the way in which we deal with work and going to work and not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Second is retail. Third thing, think about all the bars and restaurants being asked to close again, right? Think about the arts industry, the sort of stuff that, you know, we do with festivals, which is sort of on the margins,
right? Yeah, the crack economy.
Think about all the theatres, all the musicians, all the creative artists, all the performing artists. These industries are all gone now.
Yeah.
They cannot survive a second lockdown simply because they've no cash.
Sure.
And when they've no cash, what happens is the people, we're back to that idea, John, that when you've no cash, you get a credit crunch because the people who you owe money to think, okay, these guys are not allowed to open again. Therefore, they have no income. Therefore, they have no cash.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore, I don't have an asset on my balance sheet, which is called the money that David or John owes me, but I now have a bad debt. And therefore, my balance sheet is going to be impaired. Therefore, I call in my debts, and suddenly what you see is you get another credit panic in the economy, a winter credit panic.
Sure, yeah.
And then I was thinking what the people in Mesopotamia didn't have, but we have, is the bond market.
Yeah, yeah.
The bond market is the key to saving the economy because the bond market allows us to borrow from the future to prop up the present, if you think of it in that way, right? Mm. So you can borrow for what you imagine to be a brighter future in order to prop up what you know to be a traumatized present.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't available to our friends, the Mesopotamians, right? So then you think, why don't we use that? Why don't we think about that? And it's back to this idea of helicopter money. If the problem in the businesses that have been locked down, and will be locked down in the next few weeks, it seems.
Sure, yeah.
If the problem is a lack of cash, then give them cash.
Yeah.
And the problem goes away. And how do you give them cash? The Irish state just simply goes up to the ECB and presents an IOU. The ECB gives real cash. And they just give it to businesses. Now, you can have all sorts of checks and balances and obligations and small print or whatever. But the idea is helicopter money, which we talked about in March, is still the solution, John, 6 months later.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing. And the ECB is still the institution that has given us the opportunity to do this and is still saying, keep doing it. And yet we're not doing it. And so when I hear the state saying, we're going to lock down again, and then I hear business saying, well, hold on a second, we can't deal with this.
Yeah.
It's as if there's a dialogue of the deaf between the two. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's a way forward and there's a way through this.
Mm.
And that is to use the bond market in the way in which the bond market was always designed, to borrow from the future to pay for today.
Sure.
And again, I come back to it. Sometimes, John, simple solutions are avoided by intelligent people because intelligent people believe that simple solutions equate to stupidity.
Yeah.
But we know that complicating things equates to stupidity when the solution is right in front of your face.
Yeah.
And I'd say if the poor old Mesopotamians, with their funny beards and their waxed beards and their basic Excel spreadsheets, if they had had the opportunity to borrow from the future to prop up the present, they would have done so.
Yeah.
And the only reason we don't do that, John, is that the people who run our place don't have the imagination. We have the tools.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have the capacity.
Yeah, yeah.
Interest rates are at 0%. Long-term interest rates at 0%, so the money is free. All we don't have is the imagination to realise that that is the economic and financial vaccine to COVID. We have it. We're just not using it.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, as you're talking about Mesopotamia and ancient Persia and all that kind of stuff, what I do find really interesting is that, you know, this area was the cradle of civilization. You know, from there, back in the day, we got the first urban areas, we got money, we got communication, we got writing, we got agriculture, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But what I find amazing is that the area is still so incredibly volatile, largely because of the interference of the West.
Yeah, no.
You know, I also find it's incredible that a lot of the American soldiers going into the Iraq War 1 or 2 or whatever had no idea about the significance of the people and of the place and kind of treated them as backward and almost uncivilized.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's the cradle of our civilization. It's where the world begins to take a form that starts to look and feel like the form that we have. You know, we said it there, tax collectors, yeah. Bureaucracies, soldiers, kings, temples, money, of course. Money emerges there, writing, literature, all those things. And over time, they become the basis for our civilization. Semitic languages, all that sort of stuff, you know. Great yeah. Religions come from that place. The Zoroastrians and Persians, the Arabs, the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, all these great tribes come from that neck of the woods. And what has been endlessly, endlessly tragic has been the amount of wars that have been fought in those regions. Because there's three big, big tribes there. The Turks, the Persians and the Arabs. Looking for supremacy there. Every now and then the Russians come down looking for a sniff around. The Brits came down because the Brits wanted to actually preserve that neck of the woods. And we're going to talk about this in a second. And after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, John, when the Ottoman Empire begins to atrophy and when the sultans begin the gradual and then very sudden process of leaving the extremities of the empire, what you see yeah. is the discovery of oil, and the discovery of oil changes everything, because it's a thing that they call in economics, John, the curse of oil, that you're actually yeah. cursed in a way when you find oil, because everybody wants a piece of your country. Everybody pushes you around. Everybody tries to invade you. Corruption becomes endemic, all those things. So, yeah.
It's like the curse of the lottery winner as well.
John, it's exactly the same. It's exactly
yeah,
the
yeah,
same.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, on this note, John, Mesopotamia, yeah. Iran, the Fertile Crescent, oil, we have a fantastic interview and conversation coming up. A wonderful, wonderful documentary has been released. Amazingly, it couldn't get general release in the United States because it's so inflammatory. But it's actually more inflammatory about the British involvement in the coup in 1953 in Iran to depose Mossadegh, the elected leader of Iran, who actually ran on a ticket of, we are going to take back the oil revenues of this country. Now, who owned the oil revenues? British Petroleum. It was called the yeah. British Persian Oil Company. Think about it. And this guy gets deposed in a coup. Now, what is fascinating for us now is the coup in Iran sets the tone for all sorts of interventions in the Middle East we've seen since then.
Yeah, you know, the 1953 coup seems to be the ground zero for everything that we're reaping now. All the chaos and conflict and hatred of the West all stems from, or appears to stem from, this 1953 coup. But hold on, let's first of all have a listen to a little clip and then the conversation, because it's really, really good.
In 1953, the United States, together with Britain, participated in a coup in Iran.
Mossadegh and his government were swept from power in favor of General Zahedi. 300 killed and hundreds wounded is a conservative estimate.
The British government has never officially acknowledged its role in the coup.
I don't think at any time we really planned a coup d'etat.
These words have not been heard or seen for over 34 years.
Evidence that has the potential to turn a dark chapter in history inside out.
Now, we were just talking there about Mesopotamia, the Middle East, and how the Middle East has fared in our history, in our culture, our language, our religion, everything over the years. But now we want to ask the question, why was the West involved in the Middle East? When did it all start? How did it start? There is a brilliant movie just out called Coup 53. It's on in the IFI, the Irish Film Institute in Dublin right now. And it explains the extraordinary and chilling story behind what happened in a coup d'etat in Iran in 1953. And I have on the line the two men who made this documentary. One is Taghi Amirani, who is an Iranian physicist who gave up physics to start making documentaries, amazing documentaries. And the other man on the line is Walter Mersch. Walter Mersch is a legend. This is a man who's won 3 Oscars, 9 Oscar nominations. He has done the editing, the sound of Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, American Graffiti, The English Patient, etc. So, gentlemen, how are you?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Taghi, can I start with you? Just set the scene for me. Iran, 1950, 1951, 1952. Who was in power? What was going on? What was the big play?
Right. Something important happened in 51. Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh got elected on the ticket of nationalizing Iranian oil, which at the time was controlled by the British. And they had been exploiting the Iranian oil resources for nearly 50 years. In fact, when oil was discovered in Iran, Churchill described it as a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was set up to exploit Iran's oil. It took all the revenue back to London without giving any back to the Iranians. It was the biggest overseas assets of the British. And they were having an incredible time using this resource to run the British Navy, to rebuild Britain after the war, pay their debts. Iranian oil fueled Britain for a long time. Mossadegh came to power in 1951 and got elected on two tickets only. He had two things on his ticket: nationalizing Iranian oil, taking control back to Iran and kicking the British out, and reforming the electoral system. This didn't go down well with Churchill, who used to mock Mossadegh as called him Mussy Duck. And so they began a battle between the two forces, Mossadegh on one side, the nationalists on the one side, and Churchill on the other side. And so it came to a head when Mossadegh threw them out. They evacuated the refinery. The refinery was like almost like a state within a state. The British treated Iranians like second-class citizens. In fact, we have an amazing line in the documentary that they treated Iranians like wops. That's the word that's used. They were very much like second-class citizens. And when they left the refinery, they decided this is it. We have people in the film saying our goal was to remove Mossadegh as soon as possible. He wasn't doing any good for Iran. Not that he wasn't doing any good for us. He wasn't doing any good for Iran. To cut a long story short, because I want you to see the film, they couldn't really get rid of him on their own because they kicked them out. He closed the embassy and threw them all out. And so Churchill reached out to Eisenhower and said, you got to help us get rid of this guy, not because we want control of our oil back, but because he's going to turn Iran communist. There's a threat of communism. He's secretly got communist tendencies. And so the plans for the coup were in place. MI6 got involved. CIA got involved. You know, as you said in your intro, for the last 67 years, this has been known as the CIA coup in Iran. What our film reveals in an explosive way, that this was actually an MI6 masterminded coup. They brought the Americans in to help them out. So it's very much a British coup in Iran with American support. And that's what the film reveals for the first time.
Taghi, can I just bring you back to the oil there? Because I read many years ago that Iranian oil allowed the British, and I think it might have been even Churchill himself, to switch the British Navy from coal to oil-powered. And that gave them a huge technical advantage just during the First World War, when they were building up their fleet. Is that the case?
Yes. In fact, Churchill, in his previous life, the first Lord of the Admiralty, he converted the British Navy from coal to oil with the backing of Iranian oil. That was the impetus.
So, Taghi, tell me, what actually happened at the coup? What actually happened on the streets of Tehran?
Okay. When the British were kicked out, and Churchill reached out to Harry Truman first, and Harry Truman said, no, I think that he has a point. They respect Iranian sovereignty and do a deal, come to some kind of arrangement. But then Truman left office, Eisenhower came in, the Dulles brothers, the terrible Dulles brothers, who were Secretary of State, John Foster and Alan Dulles, head of the CIA. They had personal interest in Iranian oil even before then. They had personal interest in huge contracts in Iran, which Mossadegh nipped in the bud. Eisenhower was more receptive. The Dulles brothers got on the case. They masterminded the plan with the British agents. It was a classic coup plan. It was the first time the CIA were involved in the coup. It was a brand new kid on the block, lots of money. It wanted to go and play, and MI6 said, come out and play here. Bring your muscle. The ingredients were bribery of politicians, recruiting military officials, putting out propaganda in Iranian press, fake news. Trump keeps going on about fake news. Well, the CIA and MI6 invented fake news in Iran in 1953. To undermine and destabilize Mossadegh. So these elements were all into play. Of course, they had the Shah, a very young, inexperienced, and kind of unstable in terms of his decision-making king. They had to get him on board. And there are so many dramatic twists and turns that you see in the film, which kind of unfolds, people are telling us, unfolds like a thriller. Until finally, on August 19, 1953, everything fell into place for the coup plotters, and they overthrew Mossadegh. They picked an army general to take over, just like Pinochet in Chile. And the Shah, who had escaped during the days of the upheaval because the first attempt of the coup failed, the Shah returned, and Mossadegh was put on trial, believe it or not, for treason. And then jailed for 3 years in solitary confinement and exiled to his house until he died.
So he was actually Mossadegh, the elected leader of Iran, was more or less disappeared from the scene. How is this reported in the 50s? Because Iran is a huge country, a massive oil player. In fact, the end of the Second World War and the carve-up was constructed in Tehran between Eisenhower, in Tehran between Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt. I mean, this couldn't have gone unnoticed in the West.
Well, yes, it was, for a start, the actual covert operation obviously was never reported, but the way it was portrayed was that this kind of crazy, rather bizarre, eccentric prime minister who stood up to the mighty power of the British Empire needs to be got rid of because he's destabilizing Iran, he's cutting off our oil supply, and he's a threat, he's a potential, he's going to give Iran to the Russians. Iran was obviously at this kind of very hypersensitive, as you say, geopolitical position of north, the Russians, south, the Brits. And this power play had been going on since the war. And so when the evacuation happened and the British were expelled from the British embassy, the British did something crazy. They put adverts in all foreign newspapers saying anybody who buys Iranian oil is actually buying stolen oil. It's like, it's ours. And if you think sanctions and embargoes, which are happening.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. They got the lawyers. That's another thing to know. Anglo-Iranian oil company is BP. How many people know BP was born in Iran? British Petroleum was born in Iran first as Anglo-Persian oil company, then Anglo-Iranian. And after the coup, it came out fully as BP and had to share Iranian oil with Americans. So there are a lot of things happening right now which have echoes and parallels with 53. Oil sanctions, embargoes, fake news, and the demonization of Iranians. And it's a pivotal event, the consequences of which we're still living with.
Walter, can I ask you, how did you get involved in this project? I mean, Taghi, I can see, is Iranian. This is part of his family history, his own history. How did you get involved? I mean, a mutual friend of ours, actually, who you know, Idana, told me that Walter only gets involved in projects now that he really wants to. So what was it?
Well, it's certainly true in this case. I had edited Sam Mendes's film Jarhead in 2005, and in the process of doing that, had learned about Mossadegh and about the history of Middle Eastern oil, the whole Churchill turning the fleet from coal to oil, which was fascinating. And I met Taghi in 2012 when I was in New York editing another documentary, Particle Fever, about the search for the Higgs boson, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, all of that. Taghi graduated in physics from Nottingham University, and we met at the gentleman who was financing both films, Coup 53 and Particle Fever. And so we started talking physics and film, and he came to see a screening of Particle Fever, loved it, helped us get into the Sheffield Documentary Festival, where the film won the Audience Award. And we just kept in touch after that when Taghi would come to San Francisco to raise money. Most of the money for the film comes from Silicon Valley people, although not exclusively, but a large portion of it. And so he'd stay at our house and make his way down to the peninsula to shake the can and come back, and we would count the pennies and he'd go back to London. I never thought I would work on this film, but a project that I was working on came to an end. And I was at loose ends, as always happens, with no idea of what's next. And my wife, Aggie, who's English, and Taghi put their heads together and said, well, we think the best thing for you is to go to London and work on this little documentary, historical documentary, for 6 or 8 months. And as they say, the rest is history. Here we are 5 years later with many, many twists and turns in between.
Walter, I mean, anybody who's made a documentary will know that the real magic actually happens in the edit suite, in your domain, in your manner, so to speak. Was there a moment, or were there moments when in the edit you just uncovered things? You said, wow, look at this. This is new stuff. And that's really what got the whole documentary going.
That's true. And I have a flag that I wave as often as I can, which is that any film editor who works on a unscripted documentary as this one was, as was Particle Fever, really deserves to get co-writing credit, which is what happened on Coup 53 with me, because of exactly what you said, that we are uncovering things and trying to figure out the structure. New material is coming in that has to be evaluated, and frequently that new stuff upsets the apple cart that you just spent 3 weeks making all nice and neat. But that's, you know, part of the fantastic creative frenzy that goes on in the cutting room of any kind of documentary. The difference between a fiction film and a documentary film is that the editor, particularly in the early stages of a fiction film, working from a script, is really like a musician, a pianist, who is interpreting a written work. You know, how strong should I play this chord? How should I pedal this one? How quickly will I trill through this section? Whereas on a documentary like Coup 53, you are really digging deep into the DNA of the whole story and writing it. You're not writing it in words so much, although that it does occasionally happen too. But you are really putting together this complicated structure that you know, we had 532 hours of material, which
makes oh my gosh,
Apocalypse Now look small in comparison. And the first assembly was 8.5 hours long, and the film that you're about to see is just under 2 hours long. So there's many a story of how we get here from there.
Taggy, can you put into context, what is the lesson of 53 for us now? I mean, the Middle East is still a cauldron of intervention, of various alliances, of rivalry. Russia's involved, America's involved, Britain's involved, Israel doing a deal with the UAE in the last week or two. What is the lesson and the legacy of 53?
That's a fantastic question. You know, Harry Truman said, there is nothing new in the world except the history you do not know. And a lot of things that are unfolding now happened before with Iran. There are echoes of it everywhere. You've listed a whole bunch of them. I think when it comes to the Middle East, it's always been about the oil. It was about the oil in 53. It was, as you say, in the first Gulf War in 91, and then the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Incidentally, my brother made an amazing film about that as well, called We Are Many. And so we said earlier, for everyone, Iran really didn't exist, wasn't on everyone's mental map until the 1979 revolution. Everything's Iran started in the revolution, the hostage crisis, and everything that happened afterwards. We say, no, go back. Context is everything. And Walter said, I studied physics. As a physicist, I'm interested in cause and effect, you know, equal and opposite reactions, as Newton said. I'm saying, go back to 53. Everything is rooted in that original sin. There would have been no revolution without 53. The resentment that was built into the Iranian minds and hearts from 53 exploded onto the streets in 79 and the downfall of the Shah. And why would they say he's an American puppet if he wasn't put in power back in 1953. And of course, we're living with the aftermath of the revolution right now. Iran is the bogeyman of the world, the axis of evil speech, the fact that, you know, that they're ratcheting things up right now because there's an election coming up. And when there's an election coming up, Americans need a foreign enemy to unite the voices and the electorate's thoughts. So the UN resolution a few days ago to increase arms embargo and this potential October surprise that we keep seeing in various articles. So it's the original sin, the consequences of which we're living with, and people need to understand. I don't subscribe to the idea of Americans are ignorant or just don't have the information. They're not stupid. If they really understood what their government did in their name with their money back in the day, they might have a different perspective on American foreign policy. And the same here, you know, in Britain. You know, the British keep talking about this wonderful British sense of fair play. You know, English sense of fair play. The thing is, when they packed their bags to go to Iran as some kind of imperial experiment, they forgot to pack that fair sense of play. It's okay here, but it's not okay outside. And so, yeah, it's blowback. It's what the Americans call blowback. We did something then. It's blowing back in our faces now.
The other thing to keep in mind is that the CIA was created in the late 1940s as a scholarly organization. And that's how it remained more or less during the Truman administration. But when the Dulles brothers and Eisenhower came to power in 52, they weaponized the CIA and turned it into a Cold War version of the OSS, which both Dulles brothers had been involved in. And the first thing out of the box as a test case was this overthrow of Mossadegh and the end of democracy in Iran. By their own lights at the time, it was a huge success. And that also became the template for how the United States would control countries vis-a-vis to their own special interests. They tried it out the next year in Guatemala, and then the following year in Vietnam. And the installation of Diem in Vietnam in 55 was a CIA orchestrated event. We all know the ultimate consequences of what happened in Vietnam. So there certainly is many cases of all of the blowback in the Middle East, but really it's an even bigger question, which is this became a template for all of the covert actions that the United States was involved in up to this day.
Walter, I thought that was a very interesting point, the idea that basically 53 emboldened the CIA for lots and lots of subsequent interventions and regime changes that it orchestrated all around the world. But Tiger, you just mentioned something there about the American election coming up in a couple of months, the America needs an enemy. Do you think we're looking down the barrel at a conflict between America and Iran ahead of that election on the basis that it's always good to have an external enemy when you're fighting an election in the United States?
Well, as an Iranian, I hope very much not. But, you know, we're dealing with a very erratic, unstable president who's in a desperate position. And, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. Anything is possible. And I know they're pushing for it. I mean, they had a humiliating defeat at the UN just a few days ago with this resolution, and they had one vote from Dominican Republic, I think, and everybody else abstained. But there is a huge lobby that wants war for their own purposes. I know Trump keeps saying he's a deal maker, but then he came into power and tore up the deal on the nuclear negotiations that Obama had worked on for so long. I'm an optimist, and I think some of this must be just grandstanding and kind of just hot talk. I really do hope that Trump doesn't decide war with Iran is going to help him get reelected. But, you know, war has always helped politicians. We had Thatcher and Argentina, you know, so who knows?
Let's talk about Iran now, because it looks to me like Iran has won the peace in Iraq. It's much stronger. It's much more influential in the region. And in fact, as America fought the war in Iraq, ultimately to tell Iran, back off or you're next. Now it seems that America's greatest enemy has actually been delivered a victory in the Middle East, and that is Iran is stronger than ever.
Absolutely. I mean, Iran and Iraq have got historical roots going back forever, so and very close in many ways. So when that power vacuum that the invasion of Iraq created by destroying the infrastructure, disbanding the army, and creating this like mess allowed Iran to move in and have huge influence, and they've got a lot of influence. In fact, a lot of infrastructure in Iraq is built by Iranians. And yes, so in a way, they kind of shot themselves in the foot. They gave Iraq to their worst enemy. I mean, we've all heard the very cheesy joke that when Bush invaded Iraq, he got it mixed up. He wanted to go to Iran. But
gents, just as a final question, now when the dust has settled and people have watched the movie, what would you hope, both of you, people will take away from the documentary?
I think we haven't really dug into the character of Norman Derbyshire, who was not on our radar at all when we began this project. And if you see this film, he is the character played by Ralph Fiennes, or channeled by Ralph Fiennes, that played the decisive role in not only carrying out the coup under his own direction, but he was one of the co-authors of the plan itself that was undertaken by MI6 and CIA, although the CIA came in really as glorified bagmen who brought in lots of money to help grease the skids for all of the mercenaries who had been lined up by Norman Derbyshire, operating mysteriously by radio from Cyprus. And this is just a fascinating aspect of the story that is still going on today. We've found amazing stuff about Norman Derbyshire even after the film was finished. So there's a real character study aspect to this that is fascinating beyond all of the geopolitics. And it's marvelously portrayed by Ralph Fiennes in this film.
Yes. Now, obviously, the revelation of Derbyshire is absolutely fascinating. It's one of the beautiful things about a granular documentary. It makes those things possible. You see things you never saw before. Taggy, what do you hope people will come away with?
Okay, so that's a very good question. And I'm going to give you a little anecdote. We've been doing a little bit of social media clips to promote the film. And we took a clip from the film about the oil revenue and how the British were supposed to give Iran 16%, but you know they even cheated them out of that. And Iran basically got nothing of their old money. We put this on social media. And I tell you, three countries have gone crazy about this clip. The viewing figures and the debate is just astounding. Ireland, Scotland, and India are going crazy about this clip. Over a million people in India watched it. The Irish and the Scots saying, "Ha, you're talking about your problems with the English and the oil in Iran. They've been doing that to us for a long time." That leads me to this bigger picture. You know, I used to sit down with funders saying, "Give me money to make this film," and ultimately the question would come, "Why?" And I would never say it openly, but now I can because there's huge this critical mass building behind the film. I think it's time the British government officially acknowledged its leading role in this coup because they haven't done that for 67 years. I think it's time they did that. It's the worst kept secret. It's the absurd situation that everyone knows, but they're not admitting it. And it's not too far-fetched that they should really apologize for what is a historical crime to the Iranian people. You know, I think a government official apology is not unheard of. I think didn't Cameron apologize for Bloody Sunday, I think?
And yes, he did.
Gordon Brown apologized. Yep. So I would love the people to first understand the context of the history, really understand what really happened, because most people don't, for the reasons we've talked about. And then get on with us and persuade them. It's not push them, force them. I think it's for the good of their own soul to do this. It will be good for them to come clean and unburden themselves and then go forward with Iran in a more mutually respectful and understandable, kind of more harmonious relationship. And if I know apologies don't come easy to Boris Johnson, but it would be amazing if they just simply offered an official apology to Iran for looting their oil, overthrowing their democracy, and messing their future for the next seven decades.
Very interesting little detail, Taggy, there about Churchill sort of undermining and belittling Mossadegh on the basis of his surname. It sounds almost the sort of thing that Boris Johnson would do. And it's kind of typical of the colonial sneering at the colonized. Look, I can't wait to see this documentary, Coup 53. It's on in the IFI now. So Taggy Amirani and Walter Mersch, thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to us on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, David, and John and JM. Thank you.
Wow. Fascinating stuff, wasn't it? But actually, as I was listening there, I was just thinking to myself, God, I actually want to talk to Walter Mersch more about his sound design career. Just kind of nerd out a bit. He's great. But anyway, do you know what I think was the most striking thing about the whole story of the coup of 53 is the blatant hypocrisy of America, Britain, and the West as a whole, you know, preaching the virtues of democracy, blah, 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 while creating a festering wound. And as Taggy says, you know, this is an issue that needs to be acknowledged and addressed. Like, I'm not sure how that would come about, but it is a wound that needs to heal. Like, it's a fascinating story. Yeah, really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I always think that the expression from Cecil Rhodes, which was the white man's burden, which was referring to the white man's burden, it is the white man's burden to civilize Africa, was very much the tone taken in all those colonists and all those imperialists and all those people who decided that they would take it upon themselves to determine who ran a country. I think the Americans were completely terrified during the Cold War of Russians. They had the domino theory, which was that basically if you allow one country go communist or nationalist or nationalizing, it'll domino into another country. The Russians were not beyond playing the game as well and were very, very instrumental at destabilizing lots and lots of countries. Particularly, you think they invaded Afghanistan in 1978. That was long after the Americans had involved themselves in the area. So everyone's really at fault. But the difference between the Americans and the Brits and the Russians is the Russians never really said they were coming in for civilization. You know, they actually said yeah. coming in to spread Marxism. And Marxism was a form of civilization. Yeah. But no, I can't wait to see that. It'll be really interesting.
But you know, I should mention here as well is that when we did that interview with John Brennan a couple of years ago at the Ducky Book Festival, and you asked him about the coup in 53, he was incredibly uncomfortable. He was shifting in his seat. By the way, that interview is on Patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Great show.
Yeah, it's there. It's a great interview, and it's a great insight into, as much as he would give away the workings of the CIA, but I did think it was very telling that he was very uncomfortable with that element of it.
Well, that's interesting. So that's on David McWilliams, patreon.com/David McWilliams. That's John Brennan, former head of the CIA. John, before we go, Lucy has a new track out this week.
That's brilliant.
Called Runaway, and as I was saying at the top, you know, the last track, I mean, she was amazed at how well it did. Fair play. So this one's you've had a quick listen to it, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I think it's brilliant, and I'm not just saying that. It's kind of got a nostalgic feel. It kind of reminds me of that R&B jazz kind of cool scene in London in kind of the early 90s. And then Lucy's voice really suits that. I think it's fantastic. It's a great tune. Another great tune. Jesus Christ, Mac. We actually sound like Smashy and Nicey.
Well, as I always know, you know, Dunleary clearly is the home of R&B and Bossa Nova. And that's where it comes from. But let's play out with Lucy McWilliams' latest track.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk to you all next week. Take care.
Sometimes I wish I could run away, run away, run away with you. To run away from all of the things that we said just yesterday. From all of the pain that we felt just yesterday. But I know deep in my bones that taught how to love, but I want you to teach me everything you know, 'cause I love you so. Yeah, I love you so. I want you to know, oh, yeah. But I know deep in my bones that I need you.
I need you.
I never taught how to love, but I want you to.
Want you to
teach me everything you know, 'cause I love you. Deep in my bones that I need you. I never taught how to love, but I want you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.